putting boots on the ground in Libya today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two GOP candidates, Marco Rubio and John Kasich, say they want to deploy U.S. troops in Libya. One big problem with that? The lack of any stable Libyan government.
Who's legitimate? Who has the authority to say, yes, American troops are our friends and we want them here? Your friend today could be your enemy tomorrow.
Also, before the Zika outbreak in Brazil, Tahiti was hit hard by the virus.
That outbreak there was the first time anybody had really noticed that Zika could be a problem.
Plus, the popularity of marriage detectives in Britain. Some South Asian parents have used them before setting up arranged marriages for their kids.
They needed to know the truth, and there was just literally no other way of them doing it.
Those stories today on The World. Lots of name-calling, candidates talking over each other, topics that would normally come up in a junior high locker room. Yep, that was last night's Republican presidential debate. Even if you were watching, you might have missed this. Two candidates, Senator Marco Rubio and Governor John Kasich, said they would deploy U.S. troops on the ground in Libya. Here's Kasich.
We have to be there on the ground in significant numbers. We do have to include our Muslim Arab friends to work with us on that. And we have to be in the air.
Both Kasich and Rubio talked about Libya as the next front in the American war against ISIS. So how would that work out, American soldiers on the ground in Libya? Borzu Daragahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He recently was in Libya, reporting an in-depth story for BuzzFeed called Broken Land. Pretty accurate title, it sounds, Borzu, but what would U.S. troops do there? Can you even imagine that?
Well, it's hard to imagine that right now. Mr. Kasich had a good point about, you know, partners on the ground. And right now you have a situation where Libya is so fragmented. You have basically two camps that control huge swaths of the country and they're fighting each other. In addition, you have another government based in neighboring Tunisia, which is the internationally recognized UN-backed government. So you have like three governments. And in addition to that, every single town you go to in Libya has a different security configuration. So it's like, who would be your partners on the ground there? Who's legitimate? Who has the authority to say, yes, American troops are our friends and we want them here? Your friend today could be your enemy tomorrow, given the situation there on the ground.
Give me a sense of, within that chaos, how real a force ISIS really is.
ISIS is a real force. They control the city of Sirte and about 100 miles of coastline near the city of Sirte. In addition, they have presences in other cities, including Derna, Benghazi, in the capital, and as well in the city of Sobrata, where they were hit by the U.S. airstrike that caused them to scurry around a little bit and get into firefights with other militias on the ground there. So ISIS is a worry. They do launch attacks. They are drawing recruits from other countries as well as from Libya. It's a serious concern.
You know, foreign policy doesn't often emerge as a serious talking point in U.S. presidential campaigns. I'm just wondering, from your vantage point, Borzu, does it seem the Republicans are seriously concerned about Libya or simply trotting out the Libya case because it shows that a Democrat in the White House can mess things up, opening up safe territory to ISIS in Libya like many believe the Republican White House did with Iraq in 2003?
I mean, I don't want to get into the whole partisan debate, but, you know, I would say about Libya, there is a whole argument that, like, you know, Hillary pushed us into toppling Gaddafi, and now Libya is a mess, just like George W. Bush pushed America into toppling Saddam Hussein, and now Iraq is a mess. I don't think it's comparable from my point of view, because the Libyans themselves rose up. And they took up arms and they formed themselves into units and they went to war against Gaddafi, who was a brutal tyrant. And he was about to commit a massive war crime against the city of Benghazi. And the Libyans went to the international community and said, please help us. Could you imagine if the U.S. had said, no, we're not going to help you, and what the consequences would have been and how that would have gone down historically in terms of U.S. mistakes and U.S. acquiescence to atrocities abroad. Where the mistakes were made was in that post-Gaddafi period, those first few months, where, as a nice New York Times piece pointed out, America sort of lost interest and didn't focus on that reconstruction and rebuilding institutions in that country and helping it get back on its feet after 40 years of dictatorship. And you can't just blame Hillary or the U.S. for that. It was really the Europeans who said that, no, we got this one because Libya is our backyard and we buy oil and gas from Libya and and we have historic ties to Libya. And they're the ones who, I think, share a huge amount of the blame for not being more actively engaged.
Borzou Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. His recent article on Libya is called Broken Land. Borzou, thanks for your thoughts.
It's been a pleasure.
There's certainly a lot of blame to go around for Syria. There's a partial and fragile ceasefire that's been in place for the past 6 days there, though you could hardly call it a ceasefire. For one thing, ISIS is not a party to it, and some of the parties who did sign on have been accused of violating it. But for the people in the city of Aleppo, it's been a welcome break from Russian bombardment. In January, we heard from a 25-year-old woman in Aleppo named Zane. She spoke with reporter Rasha Elas on Skype about how the war has changed the way women live their lives in Syria. Rasha called up Zane again this week to ask her about life now in Aleppo under the ceasefire.
These are the chants of anti-government protesters in Aleppo. It's from a YouTube video posted on Monday, and it's a new sound in the city streets. For weeks, people hid in basements, and hardly anyone stepped outside as Russian warplanes bombarded the city. For Zain, these protests come as something of a surprise.
We expected people to be hopeless, not wanting any more protests or anything, just wanting to be left alone. But on the contrary, and they came out in big numbers, the old and the young, men and women, I was among them.
But, she adds, it's not like people are out celebrating and basking in the sun. Hardly anyone trusts the Russian-brokered ceasefire. One of Zane's friends was wounded in a Russian airstrike. And the Russian bombing has helped the Syrian regime advance toward the rebel-held part of Aleppo. Zane says now they're hemmed in by Syrian government forces on the north, west, and south, and ISIS on the east.
Aleppo is threatened to fall under siege any minute. We're very scared, to be honest.
Zane says people in Aleppo have seen the haunting images of the Syrian town of Madaya, where so many people have starved to death, including children. There have been international reports that the Syrian regime has been violating the ceasefire by carrying out artillery shelling and airstrikes. During our Skype call, I could make out the faint sounds of shelling in the background. So in Aleppo, people are preparing for the worst. Zane says smugglers are bringing in provisions from Turkey, driving on dangerous roads at night to avoid snipers. Everyone is stocking up. U.S.-backed rebels are building barricades around the city, recruiting hundreds of men to help with the task and to protect the supply routes that have been a lifeline for this part of Aleppo so far.
You feel they are all busy like a bee colony. Some are securing food items. Some are working on sandbag barricades. Some gathering fuel. Some gathering medicine. There are even ordinary families who heard that we're busy preparing for a possible siege, so they started small projects to plant their own urban vegetable gardens or get some livestock or some chickens.
But Zane says even the threat of a complete siege won't compel her to leave Aleppo. She's been busy distributing food, clothes, and medicine to families all over the city and helping out at the field hospital where her friend is recovering from a shrapnel wound to the leg. And at the end of the day, before Zane came home to Skype with me, she grabbed a shawarma sandwich for dinner from the local shop and brought it home to eat alone. She still lives by herself, which is unusual for a young woman in Syria.
It doesn't feel good, to be honest, but I'm always busy, so it doesn't matter too much.
When I ask if she's hopeful that this ceasefire might bring the end of the war, she's not so sure. But at least for now, the airstrikes have stopped. And with the fifth anniversary of Syria's uprising coming up in less than 2 weeks, she and her fellow activists are planning a major demonstration with flags and balloons. For the world, I'm Rasha Elas.
How do you even begin to calculate the full cost of the fighting in Syria and Iraq? Lives, homes, hospitals, businesses. One of the many other tragedies is the destruction of the region's cultural heritage. Groups like ISIS have made a point of destroying historic sites. Priceless objects have been lost or looted in the fighting. My BBC colleague Mariam Marouf has come up with a unique way to remember those lost treasures. It's called the Museum of Lost Objects. And every week, Mariam chooses one object in that imaginary museum to highlight in her podcast.
Well, I think you're going to have to use a lot of audio storytelling to kind of navigate your way through this museum. So it's not a real building and it's not a space that you can kind of walk through. And what I wanted to try and do was say you have a project to reconstruct, say, the Temple of Bel, which is one of the famous antiquities. How would that sound like as an audio story? Like, how would you bring it to life? How did people live there? What did it mean to people? I can actually really understand what this place is about and what it meant to people.
You're a radio journalist. How do you present those treasures not in 3D but in sound?
Yeah, so much of it is about the storytelling of these places. And so, for instance, one of the objects that we look at, it's basically something called a winged bull. And it's a creature that has the head of a really kind of powerful man, but the body of a bull and these massive wings. And I ended up coming across a man whose father was one of the very first Iraqi archaeologists who worked in kind of excavating the places where the winged bull was found. And it's finding someone who can say, well, my dad was the man who, you know, scraped the mud off this thing.
Wow.
And as a child, I would play around with other children and we'd, you know, we'd try and escape from the scorpions that were kind of littered around the site. And we'd, you know, muck around with all the bits of pottery and different things. And so to get a real sense of these are kind of lived spaces, not just objects that you kind of revere from far away.
Yeah, I mean, inanimate objects that come alive through the personal stories of people linked to them. But I'm wondering, is there any object, a historic object, you return to just kind of get that sense of optimism about the future back?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say one specific object, but what I think I want to try and do with this series, or what it tries to do, is that through all of these stories, because some of them are actually quite playful and fun, like some of them will make you laugh, and ultimately they're about how these things have affected people. I was telling you earlier about this artifact called a winged bull.
Right.
And these like really impressive, slightly terrifying things. You see them in various museums around the world. And this one that was destroyed by IS, one of the really incredible things about this statue was that at the bottom, there were these lines that were drawn onto the base of the statue, like on the plinth. And what it ended up being was, what it turned out was, it was a game that the Assyrian guards, 2,500 years ago, when this bull was first carved, they had to stand guard there. And when they weren't off on wars, when they were completely bored, they scratched these lines onto the plinth and they played a board game.
Wow.
And it's a game that's called 20 Squares. When you look at it, it looks a bit like almost hopscotch, but you use counters. So it's like a cross between Ludo and dominoes in a really kind of weird sort of way. And the really amazing thing about that is that this game is apparently still played in Iraq today. And so when you hear stories like that, you think, okay, there is a kind of devastation underscoring all of it. But the fact is that these objects represented things for people that won't go away because they become a part of how you relate to your own history in a way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. All right, we've gotten through this whole interview. What is the name of the podcast, your series?
Oh, it's called Museum of Lost Objects.
There you go.
And,
perfect.
Yeah.
Mariam, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
That was my BBC colleague Mariam Marouf speaking with me from London. Coming up, the Jim Rockfords for Arranged Marriages. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. A quick update now on a story we've been following for a while. Voting began this week in New Zealand on the future of their flag. New Zealanders have a choice between keeping the old flag or picking one with a new design, one that was chosen by popular vote. My BBC colleague John Donison reports from Auckland.
At New Zealand's biggest flag-making factory in Auckland, these are exciting times.
What I like about the new flag is it's refreshing. It's got all those things, a combination of what New Zealand's all about, I think, the old and the new.
David Sanders shows me round. Here they're already preparing and printing the alternative flag, should New Zealand vote for change.
It's come to the point where it's time for a change.
It must be also pretty good for business if you have to produce a whole new load of flags.
Absolutely. If it goes ahead, we'll be very happy.
Well, I'm just looking down now at the current New Zealand flag alongside the alternative design. The current flag, pretty familiar, blue background with four red stars, Union Jack in the top left-hand corner. The new flag, very different, designed by a Kiwi and dominated by a fern. That's New Zealand's national symbol. It's set against a black and blue background. The only similarity, really, the four red stars. And I guess the main thing for supporters of the new flag is that the Union Jack has gone.
We think it's time that New Zealand had a flag that represents the fact that we're an independent country.
Lewis Holden leads New Zealand's Change the Flag campaign.
The new flag says independent country. It says designed by a New Zealander. It says, you know, we are a multicultural country, and it has a symbol on it, the silver fern, which actually is something that all New Zealanders can relate to, as opposed to the current flag, which is just our colonial flag, essentially.
But on the streets of Auckland, you meet a lot of people who aren't convinced.
I'm going to vote for the current flag, and the reason is that the alternative is not good enough.
So you're happy with the Union Jack on the current flag?
No, I'm not. I'd like another flag, but one that represents us in a better way than the proposed design.
The idea of the Union Jack on the flag, do you think that's a bit too much of a throwback to kind of colonial?
Not really, because I was born in England. So I'm a bit biased there. But I think that's we're a small country and that's where our history is, and so I'm not sure, you know, whether or not we're ready to give that side of it up yet.
The flag debate, in a way, is a clash between the old world and the new. And polls suggest that in this referendum, New Zealanders will opt for the status quo. The result will be known by the end of the month.
The BBC's John Donison there, reporting from Auckland, New Zealand. How much do you really know someone before you marry them? Living together definitely helps, but what if you come from a culture where arranged marriage is the norm? In many South Asian communities, couples may only meet briefly before the ceremony. That's a tradition, but traditions are breaking down. So in Britain, some South Asian parents are turning to marriage detectives to get information on prospective sons and daughters-in-law. My BBC colleague Sheeta Parmar has been watching the detectives.
What they will do is a client will say, I need to find out, for example, in the case that I worked on, she needed to find out just how much the subject drank. And the family was quite religious and didn't drink too much alcohol,
right.
So that wouldn't have been a fit, whether he smoked and, crucially, whether he was going to be faithful.
Sheetal, who are the clients? The kids whose parents are trying to set them up, or the parents so that their first shot at finding a mate for their kids is their best shot?
It's often not the people who are getting married, and often it's not them because they are entering into a marriage situation and they kind of want to just believe that it's happening. Certainly in the cases that I looked at, it was either parents who were arranging the marriages or who just wanted a little bit more detail. It's often parents if the marriages are not arranged. So if you've been in a relationship with someone and the parents just don't seem to like them very much, then they will often hire private investigators to find some dirt. But other than that, it will be extended family. So it was the sister of the woman that was due to get married hired the private investigators in this case that I was on surveillance. And it's because people had approached her and said, you know, we're not sure that he's right for your family. And doubts were cast very early on. And she was doing it, she said, to protect her sister.
So it sounds like mostly these private investigators are vetting the likely partners. But you went out with one detective agency running a honey trap operation.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
So the client wanted to know whether her future brother-in-law was likely to be faithful.
I see.
And geographically, there's a reason why this is all happening is because
with arranged marriages, often what happens is they're not necessarily in the same area location-wise. They may live 2 or 3 hours away. So they're not seeing each other all the time. Doubt was cast in her mind because of what people had said, also because he was suddenly unavailable at weekends all the time. So she thought he's either up to something or he's playing around, because people have said to me he's playing around. So I need to know whether this is the case. And that involved a whole weekend of surveillance. So the client needed to know 3 things. How much does he drink? Does he smoke? And would he be faithful? Which, of course, involved the honey trap. That honey trap, he did go to a bar. So a female investigator went in with another group of women who are all other female investigators as well. We are all watching at a very safe distance. And then conversation is started between the subject and the investigator. It's a very normal bar setup. On a normal Friday and Saturday night, you get groups of people talking to each other and just, you know, just doing what normal people do in a bar. There is no way that most people would know that there's potentially they could be honey trapped. What happened in that scenario is
Yeah, I'm waiting for the punchline here. My reality show head is taking over. Was he a cheater?
He was a cheater. Yes, wow. Absolutely. He was a cheater. What happened is they established contact. They swapped numbers. And then within 2 or 3 days after that initial meeting in the bar, he had sent very graphic and intimate pictures of himself to the female investigator.
Wow. Safe to say that he's no longer a candidate for somebody's hand in marriage.
He is no longer a candidate to that sister. No, absolutely not. The wedding was called off soon after.
If you had kids, would you ever consider hiring a detective like this?
No, I would just do the job myself.
Taking it
but
on.
I do. It does. I do see why people do it. I could see it when I spoke to various people doing it. They needed to know the truth, and there was just literally no other way of them doing it. But for me personally, it seems quite far-fetched. But I'd like to think that I would bring up my kids in a way, you know, where everything was open. And we were able to have discussions about things rather than me hiring somebody to do it.
My partner at the BBC, Sheetal Palmer, on the case of the marriage detectives. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Last Sunday at the Oscars, Chris Rock was joined on stage by 3 Asian kids dressed as accountants. Then he made a joke that offended many Asian Americans.
Asians were still the butt of the joke, even when there was so much talk about inclusion. It just sort of hit home more, I guess. It felt like, you know, they were kicking us while we're down.
That story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In Brazil, police have been working at the car wash. No, this is not some revival of a disco hit. Car wash is the code name for a massive corruption investigation. And this morning, Operation Car Wash detained Brazil's former president, Inácio Lula da Silva. Investigators took him to an airport police station and questioned him for 3 hours. Lula is a hero of the left in Latin America, but now he's allegedly caught up in a bribery scheme involving the state-run oil company, Petrobras. Catherine Osborne has been reporting on the story from Rio, and she told me what investigators want to know.
Specifically, investigations have focused on money that he may have received for a luxury apartment from some construction companies. The way the Petrobras scheme worked was that construction companies padded contracts that they got to build parts of oil refineries and sort of national infrastructure projects, and they gave some of that money that they padded in to political parties and politicians. And so now what's being investigated is how much Lula may have personally benefited from this.
And do the investigators feel they have the goods on former President da Silva?
Part of today's operation was getting more concrete evidence. So several auditors entered his home to pick up receipts and sort of documentations about things that were in his house. The idea is you need to collect the evidence in order to make these formal charges.
You know, Lula was the great hope for not just Brazil, but he was this former blue-collar worker who ascended to the heights of power in South America's biggest country. So the whole continent saw him as this kind of hopeful sign. Now he's being investigated for corruption. What happened?
So Part of this investigation is an interesting opportunity to reflect on the project of the Workers' Party, his party, the PT. He fought against the dictatorship and then afterward ran for president several times and eventually was able to get a wide enough coalition to get elected by making some election time alliances with construction companies. So what's interesting is that during his rule from 2002 to 2010, you saw Brazil growing a lot. He received very positive evaluations. But what's happening now is people are going and looking back at sort of what kinds of relationships between politics and corporations led to things getting built in Brazil, the way Brazil has developed today.
So Brazil is the B in the BRIC countries, along with Russia, India, and China. The economy soared there in recent years. But what's the economy looking like now? And is a sense that corruption was just inevitable in a country like Brazil, where the economy just burns white hot for a while?
Corruption is very common here, and the economy is not doing well. One newspaper cartoon put it well, which had a picture of one person saying to the other, "Oh, I know that we've always had corruption in Brazil, but now that it's being discovered, why is the economy tanking?" And the other person responds, "Could it be that the economy ran on corruption?" And I think that's definitely part of what's happening. Investigators are looking into relationships that sort of kept Brazil going. And now that companies are having to, for example, freeze projects of theirs because they're under investigation, the economy is slowing.
Are people in Brazil disenchanted with the left and progressives?
They talk about wanting to have leaders who are coherent and trustworthy. But many folks say that sort of these kinds of relationships that are being revealed right now, aka construction companies funneling money to ex-president Lula, shows that the PT as a project isn't as progressive as they wanted it to be.
How's this going to impact the Olympics, Catherine?
The Olympics are going to happen. They're going to happen perhaps with fewer people there, perhaps because they're scared about sort of Zika virus, etc. But I'm sure they're going to be very beautiful and hopefully highlight Brazilian culture and history. At the same time, what's interesting is that many companies who built Olympic facilities are these exact same companies that are being investigated in the car wash operation.
Finally, Catherine, why is this investigation called car wash?
The first place that police had evidence that money was funneled to a head of Petrobras was a car wash station in Brasilia, the capital.
Incredible story. Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Brazil's also had a rocky history in the Amazon with environmental rights activists, but it was in Honduras yesterday where one of the most prominent environmental and indigenous rights defenders in the region was murdered. Police say Berta Cáceres was killed during an attempted robbery at her home. The family and supporters of Berta Cáceres call it an assassination. In January, Cáceres gave one of her last interviews to journalist Jenny Monet. Jenny, thanks for being with us. So you visited Cáceres in her village of Rio Blanco in Honduras in January. What was she like?
In a word, Berta was amazing. She had a loyal circle of followers and people who just believed in the kind of indigenous resilience and nation building that she was doing. And it was really a wonderful thing to see in her element.
Yeah, in this part of the country, I mean, this is a village. It's kind of odd that a major activist decides to live in a rural area, not the capital. Or does that speak to the kind of grassroots campaigner she was?
Well, the heart of the dam struggle, of which I think a lot of the controversy and the conflict swelled, comes from this rural village in Rio Blanco. Berta was from La Esperanza, which is about a 3 hours drive, but Rio Blanco was the heart of this rural struggle around the Agua Zarca hydroelectric dam project.
Was that the specific project she was protesting at the time she died?
That's correct. The Agua Zarca hydroelectric dam project began in its nascent form 10 years ago, but it really started to heat up in 2013. And that's really when COPIN, as organized through Berta, started to really ramp up the activism. Over the course of a year in 2013, there was a major roadblock around the site. And so what you had was a sit-in, really, over the course of a year that was transformative. It was very effective in withdrawing the support of major foreign multinational corporations and investors who had bought into this dam project. So it really made an impact. And at that time, it was seen as one of those great victories.
Cáceres was an environmental activist and an indigenous rights activist. And when you met her in January, you asked her specifically about the importance and significance of this area and the dam and the river. Let's hear that.
Este, el río Hualcarque, es un río sagrado para el pueblo Lenca.
She had basically told me the DESA Corporation, that's the company that's building the dam, is continuing to move this project forward despite all the human rights violations. And the Hualcarque River is very important. It is a sacred river for the Lenca people.
So she'd faced threats before. She was arrested in 2013. Did she seem scared or nervous when you interviewed her?
You know, she seemed very aware, and despite the danger, despite the perilous conditions, I mean, she was facing constant death threats, sexual assault threats. She was very aware of the danger that was involved. Even her family, while they worried for her, everyone knew that these were the risks that it was going to take for her to do this work. And much of that strength was kind of embedded already in the family. Berta's youngest daughter, she's 26 years old, spoke with me about that.
Que luchó en el tiempo, o sea, que era una persona muy vinculada al comunismo.
She said that much of this strength comes from Berta's mother, who does this work, the grandmother. She was a social activist in the 80s during the time of the dictatorship. And so she understands these risks. And the grandmother of this family would never think that she would shy away down from fear, because she was a strong believer that this is how change happens.
This risk that she was taking, is there something specific to this part of the world, Central America and South America, people who campaign for indigenous rights, indigenous land rights?
Berta's death falls 1 year after the human rights group Global Witness came out with a really interesting report. It studied the dangers of environmental activists around the world, and it found on average that about 2 environmental activists are killed every week worldwide. Unfortunately, the majority of these deaths are indigenous rights defenders like Berta Cáceres. And particularly with her death, it shines a light on one of their most scathing findings, in that Honduras was found to be the most dangerous place to be an environmental defender.
Most dangerous country in the world to be an environmental activist?
That's correct. Since 2010, they've had more than 100 deaths, and many of those were indigenous leaders fighting these causes.
So is there an investigation that's likely to get to the bottom of who killed Berta Cáceres?
Well, that's certainly what the conversation now is. The global community, the human rights community, is outraged over her death, and many are calling for an investigation. Prior to her death, she had won protection through the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that would allow her special state security protections. When she died on Thursday morning, there were no police guards or even security forces outside of her home. And would there have been, would she have been saved from the kind of assassination style death that took her life?
Jenny Monet, who interviewed Honduran activist Berta Cáceres shortly before Cáceres was killed in her home yesterday. Jenny, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Let's get back now to a story that we've been paying a lot of attention to, the Zika outbreak in Brazil. But that's not where it started.
In French Polynesia, they estimate that more than half of the 270,000 people who live there caught Zika. So it was a huge outbreak.
That's Karen Weintraub. She's a science writer who recently returned from the islands of French Polynesia, which had a Zika outbreak in 2013.
That outbreak there was the first time anybody had really noticed that Zika could be a problem. And the same strain is what we're seeing now in Brazil. So it probably arrived in Brazil via French Polynesia.
More than half the population got it.
Right. And oddly, Zika is an infection that you might have and not know that you have. Something like 80%, they think, of people who have it don't know. The rest have real super itchy arms. People talk to me about like ripping at their arms for days, blood red eyes, and fever, and just feeling really lousy.
So a lot of the same symptoms that we're seeing in South America and Brazil especially. What about microcephaly?
So they didn't notice it at the time, but once it popped up in Brazil, the French Polynesians went back and looked at their records, and they did find 12 pregnancies with suspected microcephaly. 9 of those women aborted, and 3 were born with microcephaly.
You met some patients also with Guillain-Barré. Explain what that is.
Guillain-Barré is an illness that can follow other illnesses. So stomach bugs can cause it. The flu can cause it. And it's an autoimmune overreaction. The body overreacts to the virus. And it causes paralysis starting from the feet and going up. One guy said he got paralyzed within 2 minutes from the bottom up.
Incredible.
And it can affect respiration, breathing. So it can be lethal. If you get to a hospital and on respiration quickly enough, you can survive, but it can have lifelong consequences.
And it's also being discovered in South America, correct?
Correct. And French Polynesia was the first place they saw Guillain-Barré. They normally get a small handful a year of cases. They had 42 in 4 months during the Zika outbreak. So they were pretty sure there was a connection. It's now in six South American countries that are having Zika outbreaks.
So how did Zika jump from Tahiti to South America?
Nobody knows. Before it was in Tahiti, they know that 7 years earlier it was in Micronesia, which is on the other side of the international dateline from French Polynesia. They assume it kind of wandered around the islands for a few years. They know it was an Easter Island in between. There's about a year break between the end of the outbreak in French Polynesia and the arrival in Brazil.
So, Karen, most of us, when we think Tahiti, French Polynesia, we think the French painter Paul Gauguin, but also Marlon Brando, who bought a small atoll 20 miles from Tahiti. His family still owns this exclusive resort there. But I gather some of those resources that they brought in and have also helped to fight Zika. What's going on in Planet Brando?
So there's an experimental mosquito eradication program on this island. You know, when you're spending $2,600 a night for a hotel, you don't really want to be bothered by mosquitoes. So the resort is contributing to the effort to completely eradicate mosquitoes. And they're doing it in a really interesting way. By infecting males with a bacteria, they can sterilize the males. So they're not killing mosquitoes, but they're ending the population. They've been very successful so far. It's not clear how often they'll have to do it. One of the problems with mosquito eradication programs is mosquitoes come back.
Right.
They're like cockroaches. They will survive Armageddon, and people keep bringing them there. So it's very hard to completely eradicate.
The sterile male mosquito program, how widespread is that?
Right now, there are a couple of areas around the world where they're testing it, this Marlon Brando's island being one of them. But again, that one's going to be a very expensive effort to completely get rid of them. It'll be isolated. It might benefit rich people more than the population. But in places like French Polynesia, the rich people are the economy. And so it really does help everybody if you're helping the tourists.
What about the rest of the world and other strategies to deal with this?
Essentially, killing mosquitoes with spraying is difficult, expensive, and doesn't work long term. I mean, South America had eradicated these Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, but they've come back. So there are different efforts. One of them is genetic engineering. Can we genetically engineer mosquitoes to be sterile, for instance? And that's being tested in several places. It's also very expensive, so it could be difficult to scale up to a worldwide level.
So for the poor people of the world, what hope do they have for kind of not having mosquitoes around them with these terrible diseases?
The sterile males eradicate the population. If you infect the females with the same bacteria, it somehow blocks the ability of the females to transmit these diseases. So it won't get rid of the mosquitoes. They'll still be pesky around you, but they won't transmit disease. And so there are folks all over the world, actually, in Australia and Asia and a little bit in Brazil, are testing an effort to infect mosquitoes, ideally worldwide, with this bacteria that will prevent them from becoming vectors of disease. And that seems to be the most cost-effective way of doing it, but it hasn't been tested on a really large scale yet.
Karen Weintraub is a science reporter. Her stories about Zika in French Polynesia appear in STAT, an online health publication. Karen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. When I was a kid, I used to love a soda called Tahitian Treat. It was electric red and so sweet. I couldn't touch it today, though every now and then when I taste something really sweet, it takes me back to Tahitian Treat. That wasn't supposed to rhyme, but it did. Our friend Deepak Singh still has a taste for the sweet stuff. He lives in the U.S. now, but he regularly goes back to India to visit his family and to remind himself of the desserts of his childhood.
I admit I have a sweet tooth. Growing up in India, my mother always made great sugary snacks. I'd wake in the morning, and the first thing I would do after brushing my teeth was put a gulab jamun in my mouth. It's like a donut hole, dripping with sugar syrup. It got so bad that my mother started hiding sweets from me, but I always found them. Every time my parents sent me out to get yogurt, I'd also buy a quarter pound of jalebi, deep-fried batter in the shape of a pretzel. There was always a guy with a gigantic belly frying jalebis right in front of the yogurt shop. I couldn't leave without eating a bowl full of them. I don't know what the calorie count was, and I don't even want to think about the cholesterol and trans fat. When I moved to the United States, Indian sweets weren't that easy to find. But I quickly found an alternative, donuts. Many times I didn't even have to look for them. They found me. Morning meetings at work, house parties, samples at grocery stores, even at the farmer's market. Donuts were ever present. I put on several pounds in the first year or so, and my cholesterol levels shot out of control. My doctor advised me to stay away from donuts, and I've mostly kept to that. But now I'm back in India, and I'm tempted to try donuts, but this time, Indian ones. Dunkin' Donuts and Krispy Kreme are now selling donuts in India that I've never seen in America. Stuffed, topped, and glazed with distinctly Indian flavors like rice pudding, saffron, and crushed pistachios. There goes my cholesterol.
Wow, that sounds pretty good, actually. Oh, yeah, I'm not supposed to like sweets anymore. Writer Deepak Singh lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where he tries to avoid donuts as much as possible. Finally today, it's been almost a week since the Academy Awards, and while the winners are at home admiring their little gold statues, there's controversy in the wake of the ceremony in reaction to this bit from last Sunday.
The results of tonight's Academy Awards have been tabulated by the accounting firm of Price, Waterhouse, and Cooper. They sent us their most dedicated, accurate, and hard-working representatives. So I want you to please welcome Ming Zhu, Bao Ling, and David Moskowitz.
Host Chris Rock there with a joke that kind of fell flat with a lot of people. Reporter Edith Tsang in Hollywood has been writing, is still writing, about the reaction to that bit. Just remind us what we saw, Ada, and what Asian Americans, not to mention some Jews, find offensive about that.
Sure. So it was the part of the Oscars where Chris Rock rings out the people who he says are the accountants that counted the votes for the night.
Right.
And he brings out these three young Asian American kids.
Really young. Six,
Asian
seven, eight.
Kids.
Yeah.
And they're in tuxedos and they're holding briefcases.
Yeah.
After.
And so what was the reaction in the Asian American community?
So basically, the joke was kind of a racist joke. I don't even think Chris Rock would deny that because it was almost a meta joke where he kind of plays with the stereotype of the model minority. And then he almost dares the audience to get mad about it and tweet about it. So he says, like, if you're mad about it, tweet about it. And then his extra punchline is that the phone that you use to tweet it is also made by these Asian kids.
Right.
So it's sort of like, it's this meta joke where he dares you to get upset about the stereotype, and then he like kind of almost rubs it in even more by making it a child labor joke.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stereotype being, first of all, that Asian kids and Jews are good at math and numbers. Wasn't the only joke that bombed that night. Did the families know what they were getting into, the families of these kids who were out on stage?
It was actually, yeah, it was complicated because they knew the premise of the joke, because when Chris Rock hosted this show over a decade ago, he had done something kind of like this where he brought out the accountants who weren't the real accountants. And then in that case, it was two really tall African-American men. So they knew he wanted to do a reprise of that joke with little Asian kids, but they didn't know what the specific joke was.
Now, the names Chris Rock mentioned, those were not the real names of the kids. One of the kids is named Esty Kung. She's 8 years old. She's the girl on stage in that bit. And her family's been speaking out. What has the mom been saying?
I think the main thing was that, you know, you have to understand as the mom of a kid who sees her child being plastered all over every single major news publication as an example of what's wrong with Hollywood, what's wrong with diversity in Hollywood. You know, just part of this controversy of people being mad at Chris Rock, people being like mad at the parents of the kids who would do this. You know, there's all these people like talking about something that they don't really know. And she wanted to...
But it's also building off the anger with Oscar So White as well.
Exactly. Yeah, it was that much more sensitive because diversity was such a key issue. And the fact that Asians were still the butt of the joke, even when there was so much talk about inclusion, it just sort of hit home more, I guess. It felt like, you know, they were kicking us while we're down, you know, since. So basically, she wanted to show that her kid wasn't just a prop because, you know, she was actually a star on this show called Man vs. Child Chef Showdown. And she had just finished doing a tour all over Asia where she was really popular. And the new season of the show is actually coming out later this month. So it was kind of this idea of like, look, these kids aren't props. They're more than these 30 seconds that you see on stage. And let me tell my side of the story, not necessarily to fuel the anger, because she's not angry about this. She understands it's very complicated, but just to give like a more human story to, you know, this anger.
Yeah, you're right, though. It is complicated. And now, I gather, the family has been trolled and threatened as a result of speaking out. Is that right? And by whom?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I think everyone, a lot of people don't even read the story, and they just make these assumptions. They think, oh, this mother's probably just trying to use this to, you know, further her kid's career, which couldn't be further from the truth, because I was the one who contacted them because I recognized it. I had actually interviewed Esty earlier when the first season of the show came out. So I just happened to recognize her, you know? So I was like, oh my gosh, people should know who this kid actually is because she's actually a really hilarious, fun kid. You see her for 30 seconds making a very serious face, kind of associated with these ideas of, you know, like straight-laced accountants and and child labor, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's just about kind of recognizing that these kids are human, you know, the parents of the kids are human. They're not mad at Chris Rock. They're not trying to like fuel this fire of like, we have it worse than everybody else. You know, it's just kind of a mess on the internet. But that's what happens, unfortunately, in this day and age when anyone kind of speaks out about racial issues just because, you know, there's just all these sides. And everyone assumes that all these sides are against each other.
Reporter Ada Tsang in Hollywood, thanks. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Wow, a lot of good brain fodder there for the weekend. That is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.